Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. What a weekend of news. It's hard to imagine a time in which there has been more that has taken place in such a concentrated amount of time. Of course, we went into the weekend talking about the big story of our times right now, and that is Hurricane Katrina and the storm's aftermath. But it was on Saturday that all of a sudden other issues also came into the news, with the death of Chief Justice William Rehnquist, and then President Bush's appointment on Monday of Judge John Roberts to succeed him. And so the confirmation hearings that were scheduled for the Senate, they are now going to be rescheduled, and the nomination is now not just for Judge Roberts as an Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, but as Chief Justice. We're going to be talking about this period of transition in the United States Supreme Court and what it means for us. And in the second segment, we're going to have as our guest David Davenport of Pepperdine University, a real scholar who has a vast background in terms of the law and the judiciary, and it'll be fascinating to have him help us put this into context. We're going to think about how Christians should focus our thoughts on this significant transition. We're also going to be talking about the life and legacy of Chief Justice Rehnquist and what that means for us, and we're going to look at the prospect of the hearings for Judge Roberts and all that coming up very quickly. Of course, we also have the big question of that open slot now of Sandra Day O'Connor, an associate justice position that President Bush will also have the opportunity to nominate. But of course, the big news continues to be out of New Orleans and the Gulf region, and the devastation of Hurricane Katrina continues to unfold, and so does the story. Of course, since we were last on the air, President Bush has been twice in the region. And what has begun as a natural disaster that turned into a moral disaster is also now a political disaster, and I would say just across the board. And what we have here is an intersection of disaster and opportunism, and all kinds of things are being said, all kinds of theories are being floated. Let me just tell you what my concerns are in this. Number one, I have a big concern for the truth. And the truth is that we need to look at what's going on in New Orleans, not just in terms of FEMA and the federal response, but in terms of the moral story being told there. We are being reminded again that order and security and respect for law are absolutely necessary if you're even going to have a rescue attempt, a rescue process. We understand that, yes, there are federal responsibilities here along with federal, state and local responsibilities, but sorting all that out is going to take some time. This is a disaster unprecedented in human history, at least in our times, at least in this country. You would have to go to something that has happened far away from our shores to find any parallel to this. And we're looking at an area indeed larger than the entirety of Great Britain that is directly affected by this storm. We do need the kind of investigation to find out what went wrong. And it may be that this was just an unprecedented disaster, but we should take this as a warning. What if this had been a nuclear attack on a major American city? What if this had been a chemical or biological attack? This was the first major evacuation of an American city since the Civil War. And now we're talking about cities of massive size. We're talking about a transportation system that when it works, can convey millions and millions of people, but it is not intended to facilitate this kind of evacuation. We're discovering there are people who do not want to go. There are all kinds of human, financial, demographic, communication factors involved in this. We need to start sorting all this out, but right now we need to be helping the people who are most directly in need. What we do not need is for the political process to short-circuit the rescue and rebuilding and recovery process. We need for Americans right now to be primarily focused on giving generously in order to help those who are in the most need. And I'm glad to say that there is evidence of generous giving. As a matter of fact, the Wall Street Journal today reports that now more than $400 million has been collected, and various charities are now moving quickly to spend those monies most efficiently. Now, let me just give you a couple of warnings about this. Number one, you're going to hear some horror stories about the money that didn't get where it was supposed to go. That's why you need to be very strategic and careful, exercise good stewardship in your giving. I recommend to the North American Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention, fully accountable to a big denomination that watches over it, Others may want to give to Samaritan's Purse or World Vision, two other very fine Christian organizations. Again, very accountable. You don't have to wonder about what they're going to do with the money. Others are giving to Feed the Children. I don't know so much about that organization, but it is well recommended. But when you see some fly-by-night charity or something you don't know, or you get a flyer in the mail soliciting this kind of support, or you're in the store and they say give a dollar to this or a dollar to that, I would just encourage you to think twice and be strategic about your giving to make certain that your money actually gets where it's most needed. And it is needed. You look at this report of $400 million, and the temptation for some people will be to say, well, look, that ought to help. That ought to really take care of a lot of this. That is but a drop in the bucket on the city of New Orleans and its needs alone. You're looking not only at land wiped out, you're not only looking at buildings that have been devastated, you're looking at families and individuals who have lost everything. Literally everything. You're looking at an economy that is destroyed, shopping centers, businesses, office buildings that are devastated and empty, and now perhaps also looted and largely devastated on the interior as well. We're looking at a situation of massive infrastructure rebuilding. $400 million is but a drop in the bucket. It says something very good about the American people that much money has been mobilized so quickly. But there is more to be done. I just want to encourage you to continue to give. Give through your church. Give through your denomination. Give through the charities that you know you can trust. That means public accountability. That means audited by a major auditing firm. That means a public audit. That means registered with groups such as the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. It means making sure that you're a good steward. You know, hope only goes so far. If you send your money with hope and you give it to someone that is not accountable, your hope may not get that money where it's supposed to go. Your hope needs to be matched with a generous heart and with a determination to give the money where it will have maximum impact. Speaking of maximum impact, you know, just looking at these stories, take the cover stories in this week's news magazines, U.S. News and World Report, Special Report, What Went Wrong, Why It Happened, The Health Risks, What It Means for the Economy. Cover story in Newsweek, Pray for Us, Horror in New Orleans, The Relief Fiasco. Cover story in Time magazine, Special Report, An American Tragedy. So already, there is a sense in which the news is looking at the political dimension of this, and we can so quickly be diverted. Now, those are not unimportant questions. Certainly, our government is accountable for how it has responded to this. We're going to learn a lot of lessons. One of the lessons I think we're going to learn is that we need to facilitate the federal government taking control in a disaster like this far more quickly than the federal government was allowed to do in the situation on the Gulf Coast. I think it is clear that we need far better communication and coordination among agencies. I think that's clear. I think it's clear that we do not need military hospital vessels offshore waiting for days to be called in. We need a coordinated effort, and that's going to take someone with the kind of authority and power that Americans have traditionally resisted. You see, here we are again in the post-9/11 world, and now we can say in the post-Hurricane Katrina world, we understand that we need someone in charge. On the ground in New York City in 2001 was Rudy Giuliani. By any measure, love him or hate him, an effective and efficient leader, a man who absolutely corralled the energies of his city, its government, and nonprofit sector to make a difference. In New Orleans, we're dealing with a city that lacks that kind of civic infrastructure. We're facing a city that does not have that kind of economy. It does not have that kind of social structure. Just does not have the kind of population that is ready for this. We can be talking about this for a long time. We'll be looking at what this means for the city of New Orleans. But right now, it is a reminder to all of us that preparation for a disaster of this scale, as impossible as full preparation may be, would require of us that we must allow persons to take control and say, this must go there and that must go to this other place. You can't go there. We're going to commandeer this equipment and we're going to make a difference. Chaos is no friend to recovery. And the kind of anarchy that we've seen in New Orleans is no means of getting a city back on its feet, much less finding those who may be dead and devastated and dying. Folks, I'll tell you the saddest stories that I've seen out of Hurricane Katrina right now, and there are so many sad stories. The saddest stories I have seen relate to parents separated from their children and children separated from their parents. There's the heartbreak. On my weblog just over the weekend, I spoke of one six-year-old little boy who was found carrying a five-month-old baby and trailing five toddlers behind him. It was as if he was the Moses leading them through the water under rescue. A six-year-old boy. Just imagine being 6 years old and taking responsibility for six tiny little babies, toddlers. This little boy, 6 years old, got them to safety, and then he collapsed in the hands and in the arms of a 27-year-old volunteer, and he wouldn't let go. There's something precious in that picture. The good news there is that those children were reunited with their mothers who had been airlifted to San Antonio, and in the chaos of the rescue attempt, the mothers have been separated from their children. But right now, there are hundreds of children who do not know where their parents are, and parents who do not know where their children are. We need to pray for them. Just imagine the agony of that predicament, the heartbreak that is their experience. That'll send you to your knees. We'll be back to talk about William Rehnquist, the Supreme Court, and what this transition means for America. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Saturday's death of Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist brings to a close one of the most tumultuous and historic eras in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Chief Justice Rehnquist died Saturday at the age of 80 after fighting almost a year against thyroid cancer. His total term on the bench, including 14 years as an associate justice, 33 full years on the Supreme Court, ranks him among the longest-serving jurists ever to serve on the nation's highest court. Rehnquist was a Midwesterner. He's born of Swedish stock. He was reserved in personality, warm-hearted in person, and he was beloved by his colleagues. He was the lone conservative on the court for many years, but his steadfastness was honored when President Ronald Reagan nominated him as Chief Justice in 1986. He opposed judicial activism. He believed in a humble judiciary that would honor the text of the Constitution. His personal integrity was legendary. He revered the law and institutions of American government. He is rightly to be honored by the nation he so faithfully served, and he will be. Today there is a viewing when the Chief Justice is lying in state, his body in the Supreme Court building in Washington, and tomorrow an official government funeral. Trying to place all this in perspective is difficult. We're standing in the intersection of history and so many great events. We're looking at also the hearings for Judge John Roberts, who had been appointed, nominated by President Bush as an associate justice, and then Monday morning, surprising just a few and confirming the hunches of many, President Bush went ahead and nominated Judge Roberts to follow Chief Justice William Rehnquist, taking that central seat in the Supreme Court building. With us today to help place all this in context is David Davenport. He is Distinguished Professor of Public Policy and Law at Pepperdine University, a former president of that institution. He's a specialist in terms of America's legal culture, and he can help put all this into perspective. David Davenport, welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
Well, I appreciate you joining us because I think as I look at the life and legacy of William Rehnquist, I'm struck by the fact that most younger Americans can't remember what it was like when William Rehnquist, then I guess 47 years old, went on the Supreme Court in 1972.
Well, it has truly been the Rehnquist court. You know, a few chiefs have served any longer than he has. And all of the justices speak so fondly of him, it's clear that he had a very significant leadership role even among chief justices.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the fact that when Nixon appointed him, and, you know, there's so many funny stories in the background of this, there always are in the human dimension of politics, but Richard Nixon saw him give a legal briefing when he was a Justice Department lawyer, was fascinated by his intellect, but misremembered his name, and when he tried to bring him up, called him Rynchburg.
Right.
And yet he remembered him when it counted, and that was when there was an open seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. And, of course, President Nixon had appointed Chief Justice William Warren Burger just a couple of years before he had the opportunity to appoint William Rehnquist. But for Rehnquist's early years, he was often the lone dissenting voice. Mr. Davenport, I think many of us forget that we were really looking at the legacy of the New Deal and the Kennedy and Johnson courts when you go back to 1972.
Well, without a doubt, you know, we're very aware now that many times presidents who appoint a justice who they believe will follow their philosophy turn out to be a disappointment to the appointing president when they go some other direction. President Nixon certainly had that experience himself. But in Rehnquist, he appointed a conservative who I think was by and large faithful to that conservative ideology right through to the end.
In 1976, Justice Rehnquist wrote an article, and of course this is when he was a fairly new associate justice, long before he became chief justice. It was in the University of Texas Law Review, and he wrote concerning the idea of a living constitution. He really attacked the notion. And Mr. Davenport, he went on to argue that this idea of a living constitution makes of that text whatever any majority on the court would make of it, without regard to whether the founders of this country had any such intention whatsoever. You know, when he wrote that in 1976, that was one thing. But when he became Chief Justice, was he able to bring that perspective to the larger court?
Well, I think he did in a number of cases. I would say, with the exception of this recent takings case that has everybody, I think, correctly up in arms, with that exception, by and large, his thinking and his decisions in the business arena and economic areas, I think, really did follow that. I think he had a great respect for markets as decision makers. He had a great respect for states and individuals and elected officials as decision makers, and really kept the courts out of that arena largely. But I think in some of the social cultural areas, the Rehnquist Court, notwithstanding the fact that the Chief Justice himself often dissented from this, but the Rehnquist Court, I think, continued to be somewhat expansionist beyond what Rehnquist himself would have preferred.
You know, I think that's a really important point. I mean, after all, you're looking at this court producing the Casey decision, the Lawrence decision, Casey on abortion, Lawrence on gay rights. You saw a continued expansion of this kind of social and sexual revolution. I do want history to record, and I want our listeners to be very much aware that the chief did dissent. First as an associate justice in 1973, he wrote a stinging dissent in the infamous case Roe v. Wade, but he also dissented in cases including Lawrence and Casey.
Yes, and I think we can overstate the importance of the chief justice in that sense as compared with the other eight justices on the court. I mean, at the end of the day, he is just one vote, and even though he would have preferred to see the court take what we would call more conservative, less bold directions in some of these cases, he was outvoted in some of them.
You know, looking back at his career, you now have all this analysis that is coming, and some of it coming from people who were very critical of the Chief Justice when he was alive and sitting on the bench. But nonetheless, it's interesting that I see a focus on three particular issues. One of them is that there's near unanimity that one of the first areas of the law that Rehnquist was able to impact was law and order. Going back to the Nixon years when it looked like criminal rights were being vastly expanded, he was also in many ways a proponent of federalism. And then also in these latter years, he became a real proponent of originalism, looking at original intent as the proper method of interpreting the Constitution. He was not so articulate about his methodology as is, for instance, Associate Justice Antonin Scalia, but it is very evident nonetheless in his arguments. Mr. Davenport, what else would you add to that in terms of the legacy and the importance of Chief Justice William Rehnquist?
Well, I think I would emphasize, you mentioned it, but I think I'd give it even further emphasis, federalism as really one of his abiding legacies. I think prior to Rehnquist and his leadership, I think states' rights were under very steady erosion, and it had in some ways become kind of a dirty phrase in Washington, D.C. And so I think that the notion that Rehnquist really strengthened was that, you know, states are important decision makers on everything that is not expressly given to the federal government by the Constitution. And he also constantly pointed out that the elected officials, whom people can make choices about and take out of office and place in office, really should be making the main decisions in our society and not judges with their lifetime tenure. And so I would say those are a couple of things I'd note. One more, interestingly, even in style, I think he demonstrated reserve. The Supreme Court took far fewer cases on his watch on an annual basis than in some cases. And so
all right.
I think even there he showed restraint.
Mr. Davenport, we're headed right into a break, but I want to ask you right up front, how do you respond to the nomination of John Roberts as the new chief?
Well, I think it was brilliant and absolutely the right choice to make. He'll follow in the Rehnquist tradition for a long time.
Our guest today has been David Davenport, who is Distinguished Professor of Public Policy and Law. He also directs the Davenport Institute for Public Policy at Pepperdine University. Mr. Davenport, it's been an honor to have you here on the program. Folks, you've heard what we've had to say. Now it's your turn. The phone number, 877-893-8255. Coast to coast, the number is 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back, folks. I have the honor of serving as a teaching pastor at Highview Baptist Church here in Louisville, Kentucky. And one of my responsibilities is to teach a big expository Bible class. I do that on Sunday mornings. And we're preaching and teaching verse by verse through the book of Romans. But I interrupted everything this past Sunday in order to look at the big questions raised by Hurricane Katrina. And if you're interested, you can hear this on the web. I just want to point you to albertmohler.com. That's M-O-H-L-E-R.com. And when you get there, look on the left column, hit Power Line. That's the class, Serious Bible Study for Serious Times. And if you just look at the September 4, 2005 listing, you'll see Hurricane Katrina, God in the Storm. And if you're trying to think through some of these issues, it's free. You can just go and listen in MP3 format, real audio, and it may help you as you try to think these issues through. I had a lot of fun just kind of reminiscing on the changes in America that have taken place. I say it's fun. It is fun intellectually just to try to understand the times. At the same time, it's troubling because we're dealing with deadly serious issues. Go back to 1972 when William Rehnquist took his seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, little did America know that within a matter of months, just a little bit over a year, we'd be looking at Roe v. Wade in January of 1973. Who knew some of the things that would be coming along? Go back to 1972. That seems like an entire America ago. I really enjoyed looking again at Chief Justice Rehnquist's book on the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. And my favorite part is in the very beginning when he speaks in the first person about his first experience at the court. It was in 1952. He arrived as a very young man as a clerk. And when he arrived in order to serve as a clerk to a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, he talked about the reverence with which he walked into that building. Quoting another judge, he said he felt like a beetle entering the Temple of Karnak. You feel so small. That building, I've been in it several times, it testifies of the majesty of the law. There is a reverence there. And you really get the sense that as Chief Justice, William Rehnquist never lost that sense of special reverence for the court. He revered the law. And I had a chance to meet him once. I never had a chance to talk to him. I really do not know much about what he was like as a human being, but I am reassured by so many who speak of his warmth and his personal integrity. This is a man who spent 33 years on the United States Supreme Court, and there was never one charge against him on a matter of ethics or propriety. I think we really need to honor him for that. Ideologically, philosophically, that's where I find my greatest agreement with the chief. And even though as a Christian, I may come at these issues from a somewhat different direction, I always appreciated the basic conservatism of his understanding. His worldview is based in a reverence and respect for words. And those included the words of the U.S. Constitution, the words of statutory law, the intention of Congress. And he clearly believed that there should be a prejudice towards understanding that when Congress acted, it was constitutional, until the court found a profoundly important reason to find such legislation unconstitutional. He trusted the legislative process. He did not believe that judges should arrogate unto themselves power and administration. When he came on the court in 1972, the courts were heavily involved at the federal level. They were involved in running prisons and in running schools and busing schemes and all the rest. And he did not believe that was the proper responsibility of the courts. I would say that a testimony to his success and influence is the fact that now virtually no one in America is calling for the courts to take on that kind of authority. But it's in other areas that I would have to say Chief Justice Rehnquist was not so successful. David Davenport spoke to the same issue. It's on the social issues. The social and sexual revolution that became the very thrust of the Supreme Court's work and of its liberal bent and direction over the last 30 years, that was even hardly stalled or slowed down by the Rehnquist Court. And after all, 7 out of the 9 justices currently sitting on the court, they were appointed by Republican presidents. And, you know, it's just fundamentally true. Presidents may think they know who they have when they make this nomination, but you really don't know what you have until you start to see the decisions coming down and read the opinions that are written. There have been profound disappointments there. Of course, our big hope is that Judge John Roberts is not a profound disappointment. There's good reason to believe that he, who after all served as a clerk to Chief Justice Rehnquist, would follow in that same distinguished line of judicial reasoning and of operating and leading the court. Folks, I want to know what you think about this. What do you think the death of Chief Justice Rehnquist means for our nation? And what do you think of President Bush's nomination of John Roberts to be the next Chief Justice of the United States of America? We're living right now in a flood of news, a flurry of issues, headlines, and news stories. But if John Roberts is confirmed, as I hope he is, by the United States Senate, he will become only the 17th Chief Justice of the United States. That tells you something about the continuity of the court and something about why we need to talk about it. 877-893-8255 is the number. I'm Albert Mohler. Folks, I think I can tell you what to look out for. You need to watch out for a big political buildup to the hearings that are certain to begin either on Thursday of this week or on Monday, those hearings for the confirmation of John Roberts as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, perhaps a little background will be helpful to us all in thinking about this, because one of the things we're hearing is, look, it was one thing for this man to be nominated as an associate justice. It's another thing altogether for him to be nominated as Chief Justice. This requires a higher level of scrutiny and all the rest. Well, maybe so. But just remember that the Chief Justice position is more or less an administrative position. In other words, every single one of the justices has one vote. Now, that's not to diminish the role of the Chief Justice. The Chief Justice's role is really multiple. Let's just put it this way. He is head of the Judicial Council of the United States. That means he's responsible for administering a large sector of the courts beyond the Supreme Court. He gives an annual report. Chief Justice Rehnquist certainly did this on the state of the courts that becomes very influential in terms of how Congress responds to the needs of the courts. He also, within the conference of the Supreme Court, the conference is when the justices actually meet together to discuss what decisions they're going to make. He has the right, if he is in the majority, that is, if it's a 5-4 vote, let's just take the nearest majority, and he is in the majority, he can assign the one who will write the majority opinion. That's very, very important because that has a lot to do with exactly how the Supreme Court's decision is interpreted as a matter of precedent. There are other things he can do in terms of the custom of the court. He administers the oral arguments. He's the one who presides over the sessions of the court. But when it comes right down to it, there's still just one vote out of nine, whether you're a Chief Justice or the newest Associate Justice. Let me tell you some other things you're likely to hear. You're likely to hear, well, when it comes to John Roberts, so here you have a man who's never been on the Supreme Court, and now he's about to be appointed Chief Justice. Folks, as you look back in the nation's history, that is more the rule than the exception. Chief Justice Rehnquist was indeed an Associate Justice. He was promoted, so to speak, when President Reagan appointed him, nominated him to be the Chief Justice to follow Warren Burger. But Warren Burger had not been on the Supreme Court before he became Chief Justice. He was on the very Court of Appeals where John Roberts now sits. And before Warren Burger was Earl Warren. Earl Warren had never sat on the Supreme Court. He was the governor of the governor of California. And so when you look at the nation's history, you see that that really we have more who have gone to this particular position from outside the Supreme Court than those who've been elevated from within. But that's an interesting point because, again, it's going to be a part of the mix of conversation we're going to be hearing. What should we be looking for in these confirmation hearings? Well, I'm looking for John Roberts to have the opportunity to explain his judicial philosophy. And I am also expecting that the senators must abide by the precedent in the Senate that judicial nominees are not asked to give opinions on matters that will come before the courts in the future. Now, you're going to hear a lot of controversy about this. If you're watching the news commercials right now, the advertisements being put up by both sides, those for and those against the confirmation of Judge Roberts, you're going to hear some people saying, look, we have the responsibility to ask him these questions, and he better give us an answer. He better tell us how he would rule on an issue like abortion or homosexuality or zoning laws or whatever else. And then on the other side, you have people who say, no, you shouldn't. And let's be honest. Intellectual honesty is very important here. We need to be consistent. We need to be consistent right now when there is a Republican president making a conservative nomination, that we need to talk about judicial philosophy, not particular issues on which the court may be asked to render a judgment. We need to be consistent with that when at some point there may be a Democratic president nominating a more liberal judge. Looking back, that's exactly what happened when President Bill Clinton nominated Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She refused to answer specific questions about issues that might in the future come before the court, and she was appointed. She was confirmed by the Senate overwhelmingly. I believe it was 96-3 or 96-4 was the final vote. That ought to tell us something. Some of the very people who are defending her right to answer as she then did are suggesting that that Judge Roberts should be held to a different standard. Something else we need to watch for. Some code language. When you hear people talking about deeply held personal beliefs, when someone says, well, I'm concerned about Judge Roberts because of his deeply held personal beliefs, that is a code language for discrimination against someone on the basis of religious conviction. And in particular, this emerged out of the controversy with previous judges and confirmation hearings, in particular, William Pryor, the then Attorney General of Alabama, who was up for a federal judgeship, one of the big controversies earlier this year. Some of the Democratic senators said, we are opposed to this man or concerned about him because of his deeply held personal beliefs. Well, ladies and gentlemen, every single human being has deeply held personal beliefs. And a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court has every right to exercise his First Amendment liberty for religious freedom. She does not forfeit that upon nomination and confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the big issue here, this reminds us again why a very conservative, chaste, originalist interpretation of the U.S. Constitution is in order. Because all of those things become extraneous, all of those concerns become extraneous if we agree that the intention of the founders in writing the Constitution and the actual text of the Constitution itself should determine the decisions rendered by the U.S. Supreme Court. If you hold to that kind of interpretive model, you really don't have to worry about all the rest. In reality, what those who have been pushing for the social and sexual revolution in this country for the last 30 years, what they're worried about is that this will be a judge who will not go along with the trend of the last 30 years with the courts inventing new rights, finding new rights in the Constitution that basically form a legal protection for sexual lifestyles. A legal protection for certain ideologies, a legal protection for certain actions that are now described as rights within the Constitution that, of course, were never in the very imagination of the founders. Folks, this is really important. There is always the danger that Americans will give very little attention to the third branch of government. Recurring elections remind us of the importance of the presidency and the importance of Congress. And those running for those offices have to be before us all the time, making their case, making certain that their names are known, telling us who they are and why they're running, explaining to us the decisions they've made. Judges are appointed. If confirmed, they serve for life at the federal level. They never come before us to make their case. They never have to run for office. In a very real sense, that protects the integrity of the judiciary. But for a population that may be asleep at the switch, inattentive and uncaring, it can be a license to run away with a country. And that's why we need full accountability, and that's why we need every citizen engaged, and that's why these confirmation hearings for John Roberts are important to you and your family. I'll be right back with some final thoughts, coast to coast. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back, folks. You know, a lot of people seem to be surprised by the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. I'll admit I'm one of them. I had no idea that this hurricane, as strong as it was, could bring this kind of damage. And, of course, looking back at last Monday, it still wasn't clear that the storm would bring this much devastation. It wasn't until the levee started to break in New Orleans that we really started to see the full extent of a human disaster just played out before our eyes. Of course, massive devastation from the storm itself all along the Gulf Coast. Communities gone. Churches gone. Houses gone. Neighborhoods gone. And yes, some people gone as well. But as much as we may have been surprised, we need to be reminded that there were warnings. The October 2004 edition of National Geographic magazine had a cover story entitled Gone with the Water. I want you to listen to this. This is from the 2004 October edition of National Geographic, less than a year ago. It lays out a scenario for disaster in New Orleans. It's fictional, but it's one of those things where truth has become fiction. Fiction has become truth. Listen to this. It says here, the killer for Louisiana is a Category 3 storm at 72 hours before landfall that becomes a Category 4 at 48 hours and a Category 5 at 24 hours coming from the worst direction. That's almost exactly what happened with Hurricane Katrina. And it went on and said this, people don't realize how precarious we are. That's Joe Shiada, who is with Louisiana State University, went on and said that our technology is great when it works, but when it fails, it's going to make things much worse. He was talking about the levees. Now, one of the interesting things we're looking at here is the fact that there's a lot of coastline that is now missing in the Gulf Coast. Successive hurricanes and, yes, human intervention have changed the coastline. And so some of the breaks that would have been placed on this kind of flooding, some of the breaks that would have been placed on a hurricane simply are not there anymore. Folks, we as Christians understand that nature is not a blind force. Nature is not something acting on its own. We as Christians understand that God indeed is the Lord of the entire universe. And we need to understand that we as Christians do have a responsibility. The earth is like a garden that we have been assigned to tend. We are to use it. We are to enjoy it. We are to eat the fruit of it. We are to enjoy the animals and the wondrous things within it. But we need to leave it better than when we found it. One of the aims we should all have in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina is not just to make sure from a safety standpoint that there are provisions made so that the likelihood of this will be less than before, but we need to look at this world, we need to look at this particular coastline, this land that God gave us, and make certain that we maximize it in such a way that we leave it for future generations in better shape than when we found it. It's not that we give an answer to blind nature and its awful forces. We'll give an answer to God, who created it. We'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. You get to set the agenda. We'll talk about what's on your mind. The phone number 877-893-8255. Write us at Albert Mohler, MOHLER.com. I'll meet you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.